G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Treasures from the Tanakh on Truth to You. That's truth number two, letteru.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is Torah teacher Ira Michelson, back from holidays, my friend. Fresh and happy?
Back. I'm sitting here trying not to sway back and forth.
Because you've been on a boat.
The gentle rocking of the ship.
In the Caribbean.
It was actually more than gentle rocking, but... Yeah.
Really? What, you had a bit of interesting weather on the open seas?
Yeah, so it was most of the days was, I would say, at least a 25-knot wind. And going and leaving Florida for the Caribbean, we had a head sea, meaning that, you know, we were kind of heading directly into the sea. And it kind of made it very interesting. So we had a couple of times where, walking down the hall, you'd kind of banged off the walls a little bit.
Great.
You know, a little bit more than just being rocked to sleep at night.
So you don't get seasick, right? I mean, you weren't turning green. But did you see anyone? Did you see anyone turning green?
You know, I don't know. It's always funny. You see these people walking around with the patches behind their ears. So you see a lot of people on cruise ships that do that. I've never been bothered by that. I used to do a lot of fishing when I was a kid on a boat and grew up on the water. And I've been in some pretty rough seas. I mean, I definitely have had times where in really bad weather, you know, where I've gotten sick. But typically, if you take care of yourself and you're careful about what you do, what you eat, what you drink, you generally don't have a problem. And those ships are so big. I mean, this ship was probably about 1,000 feet long.
Wow.
It's a little over 3 football fields.
So it wasn't quite, you didn't see people that were experiencing the, seasickness, right? So
No, I mean, I didn't see it, but...
Okay. So it was okay. You had a decent holiday, right?
Yeah, I don't think you want to lean over the rail with a 25-knot wind and take your chance, too, also.
Because you may be wearing it, right?
Yeah, it could be. You know, I mean, we'll get to vomit later on in the program.
No, it's going to be a theme. It's going to be a theme, and we may as well stick with it. I almost, before I came on to sit down in the studio, I've been dealing with a rather large brown snake, and I was very pleased to get that out of the chicken coop and not be bitten by it, because it's one of the most venomous snakes in the world, and if you don't die, you'll certainly be throwing up for some considerable length of time.
Yeah, well, that you do see on cruise ships nowadays, and it's really not for seasickness. There's actually something, you know, they call it here in the States, norovirus, which is really just, you know, basically what people know as the stomach flu. And, you know, it seems to be, you didn't hear it reported so much years ago, but nowadays it seems to come up quite a bit. It's that when you have 3,000 people on a ship like that, you know, one person gets sick and, you know, they touch knobs and handrails and, you know, elevator buttons and things like that. And the next thing you know, or they're touching things on the buffet and people are
dropping like
flies.
Know,
people interact. And the next thing you know, you got an outbreak on the ship. I mean, but we're crazy about that. You know, I'm a former chef, so we used to have it drilled into us about hand washing and sanitation. Mm. So Lori and I literally get on the ship with our Clorox wipes, our bleach wipes, and we clean the room when we get on, even though it's been cleaned.
Sure.
I wipe down every knob, every button, every switch, the remote, the telephone, the shower, the bathroom. I pretty much go to work cleaning before I even start. And then we walk around with, you know, bottles of antibacterial, you know, stuff for hand sanitizing in our pockets and slather ourselves up.
Well, I suppose it's worth, you know, going to those extra lengths because you're on the boat for so long and you don't, I mean, you know, it's better to be safe than sorry. Hey, I just saw it. It's also in, I mean, you mentioned vomit is going to be a theme in this chapter. But so is the snake. I've got, it says here in verse 14, the cobra venom. So there you go.
Yep. We're talking about snakes and vomit tonight.
Snakes,
folks.
And vomit. How's that for a segue?
If you have a weak stomach, you know, as Jono does and doesn't like to talk about these things, then
this is just your favorite.
Now would be the time to get the kids out of the room and take some Dramamine, Bonine, or whatever it is that you need to settle your stomach.
And while we're at it, g'day to Jason's spiritual babies and also his lovely wife, Lynn, in Ireland. And Nigel.
Ireland.
Ireland and Nigel Ireland. In Canada. G'day to you guys.
Oh,
and
Danny boy, the pipes are calling.
I'm sure he'll appreciate that. But we are in Job chapter 20 now. We're in Job.
Written by an American, by the way.
Was it really?
Are you serious? Yeah, from what I understand.
All right. So it is. This is Zophar. This is after, of course, Job replied to, was it Eliphaz, I think? He replied to Eliphaz? No, Bildad. He replied to Bildad. The famous chapter, Job trusted in his Redeemer, which was 19. But here we are in 20, and it's Zophar's turn to weigh in for the second time round. And I want to do something a little bit different, Ira, if I may. I would like to begin with the last verse. Can I do that?
Sure, but before you do that, you know, we just need to mention what's really interesting about this is that this is the last time we hear from Zophar.
Is it really?
Yeah, it is. He only speaks twice, and in the third round, he's silent. So this is kind of his farewell speech to Job.
How about that?
And so he doesn't really offer up any, you know, new information here. I mean, you know, it's spoken of in a different way, but he really goes into graphic detail.
He just talks about guts and spew and snakes and then goes. Yeah. That's really what he does. He doesn't really offer anything of substance, but what he does do is summed up in verse 29. So before we read what he does ramble on about, we'll read verse 29, the last verse of chapter 20, and it says, "This is the portion from God for a wicked man, the heritage appointed to him by God." And so what we're about to read is Zophar's understanding of what God has appointed for a wicked man.
I think the other thing to bring up, really, besides what we just, you know, that reading of that verse and the idea that we don't hear from him again, is that, you know, in the past what we've seen is in the responses they've spoken as a group, and now Zophar speaks on his own behalf. Mm-hmm. He speaks in the first person.
Fair enough. Yes, he does. And so it says, verse 1, then Zophar the Naamatite. Is that right? Naamatite?
Yeah. Well, Naamati in Hebrew.
Naamati. Answered and said, therefore my anxious thoughts make the answer because of the turmoil within me. I have heard the rebuke that reproaches me, and the spirit of my understanding causes me to answer.
Okay. So I love this word. There's a word I actually love this. There's a word in verse 2. Actually, I love this because you said anxious thoughts.
I've got anxious thoughts, turmoil, reproaches, and then he goes on with the spirit of his understanding. Yep.
Right. So what I have is the way I translated this is it says lachen si'ipai yishvuni uva'avor chushi ve. And basically, I like this word, cogitations.
Cogitations?
Thus my cogitations brings me back or causes me to return and producing a haste in me. So it's really anxious is not a bad translation. It's kind of cogitations can kind of mean like meditation. It's kind of disquieting thoughts.
Disquieting thoughts, cogitations.
Disquieting thoughts.
That's a new one to add to my vocabulary, Ira. I'll have to write that down.
Yeah, he's kind of like meditating. He's meditating on these things that are being said back and forth. And it basically says, where we see this word, yishivuni, is from shuv, to return.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's saying it's these things that keep causing me to – it causes me to return and produces this kind of haste in me to answer, to bring an answer. And then in verse 3, Musar kilemati eshma, I hear the instruction that insults me. And from a spirit of understanding, I answer, Veruach mibinati ya'aneni.
Okay, so I want to ask a question about that, Ira, because
sure.
In the tradition that I come from, it is not unusual for someone who knows nothing of what they are talking about, declare that the Spirit has told them, the Spirit has told me, I am the one who knows, and so on and so forth. And I used to hear that a lot because they would declare, I have something to say. Not only do I have something to say, but the Spirit has told me to say this, and they'd ramble on with some complete idiocy. But is this what Zophar is doing? What does he mean when he says that the Spirit of my understanding causes me to answer?
Yeah, I think we have to be careful about interpretations like that. I was actually did a show this morning, you know, where we talked about, you know, in the Torah portion this week, Vayeshev, and the idea of dreams and how Yosef, you know, kind of ran to tell these dreams. And one of the things that he's called, I mean, I know I'm kind of segueing a little bit, but, you know, one of the things that it says is that when he goes to see his brothers, it says in the English translation, oh, here comes that dreamer. Mm-hmm. But that's not what it says in Hebrew. In Hebrew, it calls him Baal HaChalmot, the master of dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Like Baal, master, or, you know, we know what Baal is, you know, or husband. So sure. He's the master of dreams. And, you know, when you talked about these people, it's say, thus says God, or thus says, you know, the Lord, when they have a vision or they have a dream. We see, you know, we see what happened to Yosef, you know, when he was quick to become the Baal HaChalmot, you know, and he wanted to tell everybody his dreams rather than sitting back and meditating on it, like Sofar did. You know, this is what Sofar is saying. What Sofar is saying, it's only because I sat back and I've cogitated, I've, you know, I've meditated on this, on these, you know, disquieting thoughts that I've had. Then, only then, did this spirit rise up in me that caused me to have to answer.
So that spirit that he's talking about really is, he's talking about his inner being, the thoughts of his inner self. He's talking about himself. He's not saying,
right, exactly.
He's not saying the spirit of God has given me these words.
Okay. No. Okay. He's not doing that at all. He's not, you know, he's in no way spiritualizing this and saying that somehow the you know, it's the spirit of God that has risen up in him and caused him to say these things.
Just as well.
Yeah, and this is something that we see all the time, and you know, we might even talk about this a little further in the chapter about the way some people use and misuse some of these verses and interpretations for their own attacks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it goes on in verse 4. Do you not know this of old, since man was placed on the earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the hypocrite is but for a moment? Though his haughtiness mounts up to the heavens and his head reaches the clouds, yet he will perish forever like his own refuse. Oh, dear. Those who
dung. Say it, dung.
Those who have seen him will say, where is he? So let me stop there for a second. We're going back to when I read that, I thought, what is it that Zophar understands? What are the traditional stories that have been passed down from generation to generation in as far as it is filtered through to Zophar and where he comes from? Because when I read that, you notice since man is placed on the earth, and I think, well, Adam and Eve. And then it goes on to talk about, though his haughtiness mounts up to the heavens and his head reaches to the clouds. And the first thing I thought of was Babel. And so it's interesting. What do you take from that?
Well, I absolutely believe that it's talking about from the time of Adam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think he's trying to make the point. And really what you could do is, you know, we could kind of end the show here in connecting verse 5 to the last verse that you read in verse 29, where he is making the point that from the very beginning of creation, from the time that God set man on the earth, from the time of Adam, that it's shown that the wicked only prosper for a short time.
Mm-hmm.
That regardless of how lofty they get, you know, even to the point of, you know, and the way I translate that is, if he goes up to the loftiness of the heavens and his head touches the clouds, yet he will perish forever like his own dung. Very similar. Those who have seen him shall say, where is he? And we see a connection when we move forward in the verses here, because, you know, it's that process of where we're going to connect this, and we made the joke at the beginning about this whole idea of vomit and things like that, but you're going to see where it goes further on in these verses about, you know, how the man eats riches and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you connect all of these together, this idea of dung.
You like the word dung?
I do like that word dung. only because the other word that I would use probably wouldn't be appropriate.
It would be appropriate. I've got refuse. I've got refuse in my New King James Bible. What is the word in Hebrew, by the way?
It's the first word, kigelalo, and that's what it means.
It doesn't quite have the same kick as it does in English, does it? I mean,
dung. No, you wouldn't know that. But the reason why I'm saying this is that why it's important in this idea of, you know, perishing forever like his own dung. What does that mean, perishing forever like his own dung? And when you're talking about it in the idea of how your body works, we know that when we ingest food, what it does is we get all these nutrients and it kind of sucks everything out of the food that we eat that's beneficial to our body. And then what remains is of no value. And it just that's what's being said here, that like that, you know, like that refuse that has now been expelled by the body that really just perishes, that, you know, disintegrates and dissipates and is no more. This is the what will happen to the man who's wicked.
And that's why they say, where is he? You know, because it just breaks down. It's gone.
Right. And it talks about this in the next verse.
He will fly away like a dream and not be found. Yes, he will be chased away like a vision of the night.
And actually, you know, when we read this, kachalom ya'uf velo yimtza'uhu v'yidad kechezion laila, it actually is saying like a dream he flies away and he shall not be found, and like a vision of the night he will dissipate. It's this idea of dissipating. And the metaphor here of the dream is kind of implying that the wicked man will be removed quickly from, you know, say the world stage.
Sure.
That there'll be nothing left of him. There will be nothing left of his wealth. There will be nothing left of his power. It will turn out to be like an illusion that just dissipates, like a dream.
Just fades away. So the eye that saw him will see him no more, nor will his place behold him anymore. His children will seek the favor of the poor. Now, this is the second line of verse 10 I want to ask you about. It says, his hands will restore his wealth. That sentence seems out of place. What do you have in the Hebrew?
Actually, I have his hand shall return his wealth.
So what does that mean?
Again, tashevna from shuv again, this idea of return. Sure. Well, let's go back for a minute because, you know, it's interesting. I didn't notice this at first, but when we look at verse 9, the eye which gazed on him shall do no more, and no longer will they behold him, you know, in his place. It seems here, like if we go back, that Sofar is reminding Job of some of his own words. And if we go back to Job chapter 7, and this is, you know, Job speaking in verses 8 through 10, listen to what it says. It says, "The eye that now sees me will see me no more. While your eyes are on me, I will be gone. Like a cloud dissolving and disappearing, so he who descends to Sheol won't come back up."
So I've got some... This is from 7 verse 7. "Oh, remember that my life is a breath. My eye will never again see good. The eye of him who sees me will see me no more. While your eyes are upon me, I shall no longer be. As the cloud disappears and vanishes away, so he who goes down to the grave does not come up."
Right, and read verse 10.
"He shall never return to his house, nor shall his place know him anymore."
Right. So there we have it. And, you know, we just read, "The eye which gazed on him shall do no more, and no longer will they behold him in his place."
So Zophar's been taking notes for a while.
He's been taking notes, yeah. Mm. So this idea of verse 10 that you brought up, where it says, "Vayadav tashevna ono," his hand shall return his wealth, or his, you know, sometimes it's translated strength. But what it's talking about there is that everything that he's that not only will he be no more, and everything will be an illusion and will dissipate, but everything that he's obtained will need to be returned as well.
All the effort and wealth that he has stored up, he now hands out again wherever it came from. He doesn't get to hold on to it. It returns from where he was able to obtain it from, is what you're saying. And that makes perfect sense, because in the New King James, I read it as, "and his hand will restore his wealth." And I'm thinking, I see where you're going. So it says it will restore his wealth.
Right. Yeah. And restore can be, you know, possibly a legitimate translation. But again, remember that tashevna, you know, there, it really is from the root again, shuv, to return, from that same word, like we have teshuvah, to return.
It's not as if he can work hard and restore his wealth for himself. It's not that. He's returning it from whence it came. And it goes on in verse 11, "His bones are full of his youthful vigor, but it will lie down with him in the dust."
Mm-hmm. Mm. So speaking of, in essence, there's a couple of things that we can see here. You know, it kind of has the connotation of the wicked dying young, and almost that the sins of his youth become so much a part of him that that he becomes like the wickedness becomes part of his soul,
mm-hmm.
but that he takes them with him to the grave, seemingly because he's unrepentant for everything that he's done.
Sure. And so this is the turn. It sort of turns around here in verse 12, and Zophar now begins to go on with you know, people's inner parts and guts and stomachs and vomit and snakes and all this sort of stuff. And he likes that one, and he sort of sticks with it until the end. But it begins in verse 12, and he goes, "Though evil is sweet in his mouth, and he hides it under his tongue, though he spares it and does not forsake it, but still keeps it in his mouth, yet his food in his stomach turns sour. It becomes cobra venom within him. He swallows down riches, and he vomits them up again. God cast them out of his belly. He will suck the poison cobras. Ugh. The viper's tongue will slay him." I'm glad that didn't happen when I was out in the chicken coop. Mm-hmm. "He will not see the stream, so that the river's flowing with honey and cream." And I want to get back to 17, but from 12 to 16, comments?
So you had some pretty decent translation there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's talking about the in verse 12, this idea of the evil being a sweet thing in his mouth, and he conceals it under his tongue. It's talking about the wicked man savors the taste of evil.
Mm.
That he holds on to it, he spares it, or he saves it, and as you said, he will not forsake it, or he will not withhold it. That he keeps it. It actually is in his palate. It's talking about, in other words, that he conceals the sweetness of evil, like the tongue that sticks to the roof of one's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
What it says in verse 14 is interesting. It says lachmo be'emav nepach merorat pitanim bekirbo. His food in his belly will be overthrown. And what it's talking about is it's this idea of that kind of like retching that goes on when one is sick. The bitter thing of vipers within him. And I reference Deuteronomy 32:33 here, you know, just to kind of give you an idea of a similar time that we see this, you know, related to either food or drink. And Deuteronomy 32:33, which is where Moshe is given that poem or that song that, you know, the people are meant to memorize. It says their wine is wrath. The wine is wrath of the serpents or the asps, the cruel venom of vipers.
Mm.
And so when we look at that verse, the next two verses are seen together as well, as we see this theme of vomiting. We see this idea of the food that's in his belly being overthrown. In other words, everything that he does will be turned around on him, that everything he seeks to, you know, fill himself with, you know, will cause him to retch, so to speak. And, you know, I know we're being very graphic, but this is what Zophar is doing. Mm. And, you know, look, if you remember, all of us remember a time in our lives where we got sick, whether it was for, you know, our own stupidity, because we were wicked, you know, if we went out and those of us be, you know, before we were following Torah or following God and we went out and maybe drank too much. We remember what it was like when you would start to retch, you know, when you would start to heave.
As if, you know, this is really the picture thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, but so the truth is that because I'm using that example only because it's not like, you know, on the ship where you're touching something and you get sick. This is really talking about a wicked person that does these kind of stupid things and fills himself with things that causes him to, you know, to retch and to heave as a result of the things that he's ingested.
If I had to write a book of the stupidity of my past in my youth, I'd have volumes. But here it is, and he's talking about. Isn't this funny? Yeah. I mean, just before we began the program, I picked up on all the vomit, the theme of vomit and guts and everything. I didn't pick up on the theme of snakes. And it's funny that just before we started, I had to disappear and go and deal with a rather venomous snake. And here we are, and it's quite prominent. But he says in verse 17,
Oh, wait, we didn't do. I have to read 15 and 16. I have a great commentary that I want to read. You'll love this.
Go on.
So in verse 15, where you said that we have that theme again, the riches he swallows, he has caused to vomit, and from his body or from his belly, God will dispossess them. I love that it says God will. Yeah, actually, God will dispossess them.
That's interesting. Things, those dispossess. Riches. So I've got God casts them out, them out of his belly. You've got dispossess. Okay, sure.
Yeah. And so we have this very graphic metaphor, but I love that this one commentary, this is how they translate it. And this is a commentary. It's not a translation of the verse. They say, never is a man so helpless as when his insides spew forth the bitter, malodorous rot, which his body has refused to accommodate. I love that.
You got to read that again.
What? Yeah, it says, I know, you've messed it up by laughing. It says, never is a man, this is actually a rabbinic commentary. It says, never is a man so helpless as when his insides spew forth the bitter, malodorous rot, which his body has refused to accommodate. But you know, the truth is at the end of this verse.
You've been hanging out so far. I mean, just to read that one thing, haven't you? You've been looking forward to this one.
Oh, I have. Yeah, I have stars. I have stars around that one. Anyway, but you know, the point is that when we look at verse 15 and we look at this idea that, you know, this theme that we're talking about of, you know, this dispossessing, where it says God will dispossess them. Hmm. You know, the end of the verse really tells us that this writhing body is not its own master, that this heaving and retching and everything else is not caused, as I said, outside force like a sickness, but it's a result of what this person has chosen to ingest, and that we're seen here very clearly that it's God is the one that causes the purging from this person. And then, of course, you get into verse 16 and 17. You know, where it talks about the poisonous viper's venom, he will suck, and the viper's tongue shall kill him. Some people actually compare this when you talk about snakes, and you and I were looking at the Eastern brown snake, which is the one that you had to go out and take care of in the chicken coop. Mm. You know, one of the things you talk about with venom is milking. They actually call it milking.
True.
The venom from a snake. And some of the commentaries talk about this, and they compare this in this idea of the type of things that he ingests. And they make this distinction between mother's milk and the milk of vipers that one ingests.
It reminds me, just when we're talking about the Eastern brown snake, I actually had one in the house. I don't know, maybe it was this time last year, and I was talking to Nemo. I was on Skype to Nehemiah, and I had to go and get something in the hallway, and I saw this thing glistening in the dim light in a corner of the hall. Fortunately, it was just a young one, and I went and got the barbecue tongs and picked it up by the neck, and man, it was angry when I did that. It was a cranky little snake, but yeah. I put him in the tin and I took him outside, and I dropped it out on the driveway and put the shovel through it. Boy, they're tough to get through.
Yeah, and so we only had one snake in the house one time.
You have alligators there where you are. What are you talking about?
Yeah, we do. But we had a snake in the house one time, and Lori called me, and I went out, and we you know, she actually was trying to get the snake in a shoebox and trying to push it out through the door in the garage, and when it got to the threshold, it kind of snuck out from under the box, and I said, I've had enough of this. So I went into the drawer, and you know, of course, I've talked about being a chef in a previous life, and so I got my Chinese cleaver out. I made sushi.
I was out there with the garden hoe, and I thought, if I miss this guy, it won't miss me. So I decided not to do it, and fortunately he left. But you made sushi with yours. Yeah. Oh, dear me. Snakes.
So where were we at? We're at verse 17.
Wait. Before we get to 17, let me just ask you, have you ever had an alligator in the area?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, so at the house that we used to live in, we had a lake right behind our house. Mm-hmm. And on the other side of the lake, there was there were no houses, and mm-hmm. you know, people had cattle there and other animals. And, nice. And there seemed to be like a small lake on that side too. And, you know, they kind of tend to move back and forth through bodies of water. And mm-hmm. and so, you know, I go out there one day and there's on the other side of the lake, you know, there's this alligator, probably, you know, not a big one, probably about 6 footer, mm-hmm. you know, sunning himself on the shore of the lake there. And I went out and back with my dog, with Bear. Mm-hmm. And Bear is not a little dog. I mean, you know, he's probably about 75, 80 pounds. So, and here this alligator looks at us and decides to pop into the water and start heading towards us.
Oh,
and,
truly.
You know, I had some, I said, you know, I was actually egging him on and saying, you know, come on over. I could use another pair of alligator shoes.
You need some more sushi.
Yeah, I had something in my pocket for that alligator if he he got close enough.
Oh, okay. So you could have done him in, but you've, yeah, so you've seen. You've seen.
Yeah, like, yeah. We alligators are, you know, a common thing here, and you have to be careful with little dogs actually because they will come up out of the water.
Oh, really? And just take it.
Oh, well, yeah, yeah. We, that's happened.
It's
yeah,
been in the in the news just recently. Unfortunately, a couple of lives lost up the northern end of Queensland, where I hear the recent numbers are something like 80,000, a population of 80,000 crocodiles up there now, and they're wondering if they should do something about it. So, anyhow,
well, we actually have a hunting season for alligators here.
Well, that's what they're talking about. They're talking about having crocodile hunting season now, because there was a time in the 70s when the population was down to about 5,000. Now it's up to about 80,000. They think, you know, maybe we can make some money out of this, and you know, perhaps it's not a bad idea to keep the
numbers. Well, so it's not like, yeah, I mean, it's not like anybody can go out and do that. You need to, you know, you need to get registered, and it's a licensing thing here in Florida, but it does keep the population under control. And so that's what they've done here for many years.
So it goes on in verse 17. I want to focus in here. He will not see the stream. Okay, so he does. He sucks the poison of the cobra. That's his diet. Mm-hmm. He's up for that. But he will not see the stream. The river's flowing with honey and cream. Now, that when I read that, I thought, hey, kind of reminiscent of the land of milk and honey. Is there any correlation there?
I don't know that I'd necessarily say that. I have the streams of honey and butter. I mean, honey and cream could work as well.
Hmm. Okay. But not necessarily. Is it perhaps, does it suggest that there was a saying that might be similar to that of the land flowing with milk and honey?
It's possible. I've never looked at it. I may have to look at that now that you brought it up.
Interesting. Anyhow, verse 17. 18, he will restore that for which he labored. And I suppose that's in the same thing that it's talking about in verse 10 that we focused in on. His hands will restore his wealth. He will restore for that for which he labored and will not swallow it down. From the proceeds of business, he will get no enjoyment, for he has oppressed and forsaken the poor. He has violently seized a house which he did not build.
Yeah, and so when we look at these verses, in other words, and that's a pretty good translation. I like that the second part of verse 18. I have like the wealth that he exchanges and he does not delight, which is more of a literal translation. But yours is a good translation because what it's telling us is that he's not going to profit from the exchange of goods. Like anything that he does to profit, he's not going to receive anything. Mm. And what so far posits here is that the wicked man has kind of proffered or prospered off of the stolen fruit of other people's work.
Mm.
That even if he has already put food in his mouth, he will not even be able to swallow it. And of course, it's a metaphor, you know, talking about the food. And this exchange spoken of in the second part of the verse implies that the poverty that will come about will be greater than any wealth that he might have acquired by doing just what we see in the next verse. He answers it. Why does all this happen to the wicked man? And it's answered in verse 19. Mm. It says, because he crushed and has forsaken the poor, and I have the house he robbed, he will not build up. And this kind of reminds me of, you know, I've been in this kind of situation where we've seen people try to prosper off of other people's suffering. Mm-hmm. Especially we see this in Florida, like when there's a hurricane, you know, when I was involved in Hurricane Andrew, or you see it with Hurricane Sandy that took place up in the Northeast just this year, you know, not too long ago, that when people's houses are destroyed, that there are these people that typically come in and you know, they want to come in and they want to rob these people of their homes for like next to nothing. Mm. And then they try to rebuild them and sell them and make a profit and everything else, kind of prospering through the sufferings of others. And basically what Sofar is saying here is that even if you do that, even if you crush the poor and you've forsaken them and you try to rob or take their houses by violence, you will never be able to build up those houses.
Mm.
You'll never be able to prosper from
and,
that.
And again, Ira, there's a lot of truth in what Zophar is saying, but again, it's being misapplied to Job. And so it is interesting. He goes on to say, because he knows no quietness. Now, I've got, Ira, in verse 20, because he knows no quietness in his heart.
Mm-hmm.
What do you got?
Because he was not quiet or at ease in his belly.
In his belly. And it's interesting that they chose to put heart. They did put a little asterisk there. I do go down. It says literally belly. And I think, well, why didn't you put that in the first place? But it, because it makes sense if it says belly. There's no quietness in his belly. He will not save anything he desires. Nothing is left for him to eat. Therefore, his well-being will not last. And it seems to me, if you allow it to say belly, his stomach is grumbling and it doesn't settle and there's no satisfaction in his stomach. There's no quietness there. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. And it's kind of likening it back to this theme again of the idea of, you know, vomiting. It's as if it's as if he could not get enough. That in other words, he was not satisfied that all he had already devoured, that there was no ease in his belly. Like, it's like, you know, no matter what he does, he wants more and he wants more. And, you know, I mentioned this to you earlier. It reminds me of a kind of a funny thing, but, you know, it's kind of very pictorial in that there's this character. You know, I'm a big fan of Monty Python. I don't know if you were, you know, growing up, but I've always been a big fan of Monty Python. And one of the movies they did was called The Meaning of Life.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a scene where this, in this French restaurant, this man, Mr. Creosote, walks in and he's this, you know, very, you know, extremely obese man that goes in and he starts ordering food and they bring him a bucket and he's, you know, vomiting, you know, he's spewing into this bucket. And then finally, John Cleese, you know, tries to tell him, oh, how about this little thin mint, you know, and no, I couldn't eat another thing. You know, you go through this whole thing. And finally, he eats that thin mint and he explodes in the movie, you know, and I know it's a funny story, but that's the point. The point is that here's a guy, you know, we're using comedy. But that's the picture that's going on here. It's that no matter what this guy ate, it wasn't enough. I mean, he was willing to vomit up in order to be able to put more food in his mouth. And this is the picture that we're trying to get here of this, or the picture that that Zophar is trying to paint for us of this wicked person.
Mm. In his self-sufficiency, he will be in distress. Every hand of misery will come against him when he is about to fill his stomach. God will cast on him the fury of his wrath and will rain it on him while he is eating. He will flee from the iron weapon. Well, how's this? He will flee from the iron weapon. A bronze bow will pierce him through. You're going to like this, Ira. It is drawn and it comes out of the body. Yes, the glittering point comes out of his gall. Oh, why?
Why? Why, the man asks. So,
I mean, okay, here we are. He's painting this picture of this person who's trying to, you know, he just keeps eating and eating, trying to be satisfied, but he can't be satisfied. And not only that, but when he's about to fill his stomach, God will cast him the fury of his wrath and will rain down on him while he's eating, and he will flee from the iron weapon, and a bronze bow will pierce him through. It is drawn and comes out of the body. Yes, the glittering point comes out of his gall.
Right. And I think that what it's trying to say here is that in all these verses that we come up to this point, that it's kind of making the point that it's at the height of his success that all of this comes upon him. All of this comes upon the wicked man.
Mm.
Because it says in verse 23, it will be that when he fills his belly, and then it says, he will send in him a burning anger, and it will rain down on him. It will rain down on him in his flesh. And there's a couple of different ways to translate that word, bilchumo, which is the last word, which you might have as a weapon or...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got an iron weapon.
Translated as weapon. But who's the he there? The he is talking about God there. And we know that God was already mentioned in verse 15 because God is the one that causes him to spew, if you remember, or you know, dispossess, you know, what he's taken in. And so some have this word as weapon or battle, and it will rain down on him. He will rain down on him his weapon.
But Job has already made reference to the archers, hasn't he? The archers of God that pierce
him. No, not yet. Well, yeah, Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Not in this. You're talking about in another chapter. Yeah, absolutely. So that word in the Hebrew, the last word there, in verse 23, which is bilchumo, you know, can be translated as coming from the Hebrew lacham, which means to fight. And actually, others have lechem, food, meaning that so some translate it as that he will rain down this battle upon him or in this fight. And it would make sense based on the next verse. Mm. And some have lechem from lechem, food, meaning that because it's talking about food and vomit and spewing and everything else, that he actually rains down his anger upon his sustenance.
So I've just gone in search of that verse. I found it, and it's very interesting. So I'm going to read this out. And this is Job chapter 16 from verse, let's see. I'm going to go from verse 12. I was at ease, but he has shattered me, he being God. He has also taken me by my neck and shaken me to pieces. He has set me up for his target. His archers surround me. He pierces my, now it has heart, but if we go down, because I've got a little asterisk there, Ira, literally kidneys. He has pierced my he set me up for his target. His archers have surrounded me. He's pierced my kidneys and does not pity. He pours out my gall on the ground and so on and so forth. He breaks me wound upon wound. He runs at me like a warrior. And so surely Zophar is responding to that. He's picked up, he's made some notes there, and he's thrown that into the mix.
Oh, sure, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I want to show you a verse here that really speaks about this fire. That's you know, this burning anger that's rained down upon him, because it's a similar word that's used in this in Isaiah chapter 47, verse 14. It says, behold, they will be like straw. The fire shall consume them. They shall not deliver themselves from the hand of the flame. It shall not be a coal to warm nor a fire to sit in front of.
Hmm.
And so this is the same, this a very similar word that's used here in Isaiah 47:14. And so this fire that's being rained down is certainly not a fire that you sit in front of to gain warmth from or to cook on or anything like that. This is, again, that anger that's the flaring of God's nose that we talked about. And again, you know, verse 24 supports the idea of the weapons or the fight being the translation, because it says he shall flee from the weapon of iron. And he will be shot through with a bow of copper or a bow of bronze.
Mm-hmm.
And what it's saying there is that no matter what he tries to run from, there's two different things here. You flee from the weapon of iron. Like, there's no getting away from this.
Mm.
It doesn't matter if God brings a sword against you or whatever. You can try and run away from that, but the arrow will pierce him, will pierce the wicked.
And so again,
there's nothing he can do to avoid the battle that God has brought against him.
And it's worth pointing out, I think at this point, just to remind us and the listeners, that he does speak a lot of truth here so far, but he's misdirecting those truths at Job. And we need to remember he is directing this at Job, and he is saying that Job is wicked, and that Job sucks on the poison of cobras, and that Job has done violence and oppression of the poor and forsaken the poor and seized their house. He's all of these things he is directing at Job and saying, you are such a one, you're guilty of these kind of things, this is why it has happened to you. And so he goes on, terrors come upon him, total darkness is reserved for his treasure, an unfanned fire, here it is again, will consume him, it shall go ill with him who is left in his tents, the heavens will reveal his iniquity, and the earth will rise up against him, the increase of his house will depart, and his goods will flow away in the day of his wrath. His, I've got with a capital. At least the New King James translates that as God's wrath.
Right. And so this, you know, in verse 26, there's, you know, it's an interesting use of this idea of the unfanned fire, or this fire that is not, the bellows are not used on it, you know, to increase the, you know, the heat of the flame.
Mm-hmm.
And some consider that unfanned flame to be that of Gehinnom. Talking about Gehinnom, meaning that it's, and I think that's interesting because we discussed early on in one of the shows the possibility that all of these interactions were actually taking place in a spot similar to that, or at least something like Gehinnom, because of Job's physical condition.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been the only place where someone like Job would have probably been able to sit due to his physical condition. And the reason why they talk about this being Gehinnom, because it's this idea of an unfanned flame, causes a more lingering suffering because it's a slow burn, you know, as opposed to something that's fanned that or the bellows is taken to it. Like, you know, when the blacksmith uses the bellows to increase the heat of the flame, you know, that would consume something quickly. This is talking about how the wicked man suffers slowly.
And so, continue. Yeah.
No, and I was just going to say, and you know, just moving on, that you know, when it talks about the heavens uncovering his iniquity and the earth shall rise up against him, that basically by the weight of this misery that will descend upon the wicked man, you know, it's basically saying, look, you know, everybody can see what's going on with you. Everybody can see what's, you know, what you look like and this whole interaction that's taking place. It's, I mean, look, the weight of the misery that descends upon the wicked man is seen by all people. I think verse 28, it says, Yigel yivul beto nigarot biyom apo. The produce of his house will be removed, flowing out in a day of anger. It's like this. It's almost talking about like gushing water, flowing water there in verse 28. And then, as you said, in verse 29, this is the portion of a wicked man from Elohim. The possession intended from God.
Now, the possession you've got the possession intended from God. Now, does that in the beginning? I notice, Ira, that they are saying to Job, his so-called friends are saying to him, "You're clearly guilty. What you need to do is just, you know, own it, just own it, and repent." And it's like they're a little bit concerned for him, and they're saying, "If you repent, will he not receive you? If you repent, will you not be restored? Come on, just admit it. Look at yourself. Stop being so stubborn and stiff-necked, but repent, because you've clearly done something. Otherwise, you wouldn't be in this situation. Come on." But now, Ira, this verse 29, does it suggest you've gone too far, Job? There is no repentance for you.
I'm not so sure that that's the case, and there are a lot of different opinions on what so far is doing here. I've actually seen some people say that so far as, you know, is not bringing a stronger rebuke as you and I basically see coming here. And so for me, what I see in those last verse is that so far has basically had his say. And it's summed up in the fact that from the very beginning that we talked about in verse 4, from the beginning of the time that man was set on earth, that all men have always been seeking to understand why the wicked seem to prosper. And he makes it clear in this final verse that all of it is ordained by God, that there's no accidents or mistakes in the providence of God, that basically that no matter what Job says, no matter what he says in his argumentation or what he tries to refute, no matter how he tries to stand up for himself, he will have to come to the understanding that whatever is happening to him is happening within the framework of the providence and justice of God.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. And there it is. And now we're at chapter 21, which is Job's discourse on the wicked. He replies to Zophar. We're going to get to that next week. Ira Michelson, Torah teacher, my friend, thank you for coming back on to Truth to You. Missed you.
It's been a pleasure, and I couldn't wait to get back. I mean, it's been, I don't know, a week or two before we've put anything out, and you know, I hope everybody's been sitting on the edge of their seats waiting.
Of course, they've been sitting on the edge of their seats.
For the next installment.
But just a reminder to the listeners: if you were going through withdrawal symptoms, it's probably because you're not on his Facebook page, Treasures from the Tanakh Facebook page. You can go there, like that, and interact with the information there, because there's other things that Ira obviously does apart from Treasures from the Tanakh and Truth to You. So go there and Treasures from the Tanakh Facebook page, like it and interact. Thank you, my friend. Thank you, listeners. Until next week, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.